All right, everybody, we are back. It is the summertime. I'm recording from beautiful California, and by beautiful, I mean it's not like New York City where it's 90 degrees and sunny. Here in the Bay Area, it is 60 degrees and cloudy, which is like a fucking dream. Visiting family is like an absolute dream. I am blessed today to be joined by basically an organization that's having its coming out party here on the Antifada. This is very exciting. The Caucus of Rank and File Electrical Workers, they're a dissident rank and file caucus within the IBEW. They have been quietly organizing for a long time. We'll talk about it. I've been familiar with their enterprise. I've been excited about it. So I can't tell you how much I'm excited to have with me three rank and file electrical workers. We have Scott and Leo from Virginia, from Local 666, and Emily from West Virginia. So we got both Virginias in here. And Emily, if I don't know the West Virginia IBEW local number off the top of my head, I apologize. What is it?
I am from 968, but we believe it or not, have more than one.
Oh, nice. Excellent. Well, we're going to be delving into right here the ancient world of the building trades, a world that, you know, is obviously familiar to a lot of people who listen to the show. It's kind of one of the things we talk about, but not something that's very familiar, I think, to the average person, certainly not to the average leftist. So you guys are going to help walk us through what it means to have a crew. One of my favorite songs is by a hardcore band called 7 Seconds from Reno, Nevada from the 1980s. And they have a song, "The crew is me, the crew is you, yeah, we're the crew." And that's what I think of every fucking time I think of your caucus. So I'm going to go ahead in no particular order here, and I'm going to start asking some questions. I'm going to start with Scott, because Scott and I have actually met in person. Scott was there at the inception of another organization, the Independent Labor Club of North America. He was at the inaugural meeting in Queens over a year ago. So Scott and I know one another in real life. Scott, what's the idea here? You're one of the main founding organizers of CREW. What was the idea behind this rank and file caucus? What do you seek to address? And what are you guys up to?
It was great getting up there to that meeting, Sean. I think I've been listening to your show off and on for practically since it started, you know.
Oh, thank you.
Going up there last February for that inaugural meeting of the Independent Labor Club, that's the first time you and me are the same age. I'll be 45 in 4 months. That was the first time in my life I'd been north of the Mason-Dixon line. You know, so I went like right into the center of it. I got off the bus at, I don't remember what it's called. It's like on the western side of Manhattan.
It's called the Port Authority bus terminal. It's about the worst place in New York City. That was your inauguration.
There's like that big sculpture that you can kill yourself jumping off or something
Oh, the vessel. Yeah, you got off at Hudson Yards. Hudson Yards, which the contractors used very successfully to break many of our trades. But that's a whole other story. So you arrived in front of the shawarma, or the vessel, as it's called. And you came right to Ridgewood, Queens, to Woodbine.
Yeah.
It was great to meet you there. And this is where you told me about your project, and that kind of brings us to where we are today, over a year later.
When I tell like the story of CREW, there's like a very in-depth version that if I give that in-depth, I'll have to say a lot of names and dates.
Okay.
And maybe these are people whose names and dates I don't want to say, but I can give a much more broad version.
Yeah.
So IBW 666 Richmond, Virginia, we had 115th anniversary this year. We've been around for a long time. And for most of that time, we were like, you know, I suppose I'm probably going to piss off some of the guys in my local saying this, but I don't imagine they'll listen to this show. This was for a long time a very typical Southern good old boys local, you know. So I'm not saying nothing bad about the guys who were in that local, and I will say those guys are what built the team that changed my local. But let's be honest, the whole point to locals like that is to like corral the benefits of being in a construction union, largely inside white rural men. It's just the truth, you know?
Right.
I think we admitted our first black member sometime in the late 80s, something like that. So do the math on that real quick, how long we were just lily white. It's a long time. Anyway, so we had a change, let's call it a change in organizing strategy, around 2018, because we just got a whole new set of faces in the hall. And this is, again, not to say anything terrible about the crew who had been running it previously. They just had a particular orientation they were raised in, you know? And I think what if I talked to the people who have been running things for the last 7 years, they would say they might talk about issues of justice, right? But it is just as likely, and in fact, you know, more true in an economic sense, that everyone can see that if you're a white rural male local in a market of a reasonable size, and you stay that way, you're just gonna fucking drown. You're just gonna drown. We all know this. The language of construction in the U.S. is Spanish. There's more and more women on the job site every day, and so they made the decision to expand that, right? So in a relatively short time, we started sweeping up a lot more black members. Richmond's roughly half black. A certain number of Latinos. More women. I think the average number of women right around that time went from, you know, it would hover around like 10 or 12 in the local, up to like 60 or 70 in the local within a few years, which percentage wise is enormous. It's still considerably less than 1%, but still, no, I'm doing the math wrong. It's less than 10%.
It's a shift, though. If there's a marked shift you've noticed.
Right. And it also ended up sweeping up a lot of people who, admittedly, were getting into the job to make money. You know, a lot of us had maybe worked in restaurants, retail, that kind of thing, where you can work 70 hours a week and be broke as hell, like forever. But also, we maybe had political commitments which were at least progressive, you know? And so we kind of, you know, over time, you meet people on the job site in the apprenticeship. It can sometimes be kind of obvious who the other people who think differently than like the loudest reactionary voices are, you know? And we started trying to look for ways to like for places to put that energy, you know? So we started out doing, you know, strike support for labor actions here. I remember a bunch of us ran, an event supporting Starbucks United that Sanders came on down to speak at. Sanders and Marianne Williams, and like eight of us like ran the merch table for like 4 hours straight, you know. Somewhere in there, we founded a local affiliate of the Southern Workers Assembly. It's called the Richmond Workers Assembly. Still going strong. And honestly, by the way, the Southern Workers Assembly is not too different from the independent labor clubs. When you guys first got going.
You were mentioning that to me in person last year, and we've looked into the organization. You know, after this conversation we're having here in public, in private, perhaps we could talk about ways in which we could better coordinate. But the Southern Workers Assembly sounds great. It's like a, it's not a union, it's not a political party, it's sort of a secret third thing, kind of what the ILC is doing, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. When you guys were first starting, I was jokingly calling it to friends of mine down here, the Northern Workers Assembly. Anyway, so
I
like
accept
starting
it.
being, you know, the certainly Leo and myself, but other founding crew members being active in starting that, it brought us into comradeship, into friendship with people specifically from VCOR, that's the Virginia Caucus of Rank and File Educators. Now we knew about the rank and file labor movement, like we know about TDU, we know about UAWD, but like those are people that are like up here or far in the past, you know? We meet these people from VCOR and they're like, oh, these are just like regular dipshits like me, you know? And that kind of like it puts something in our heads that we don't have to wait around until someone comes around and makes this thing. We could actually do it. And then I think I gotta hand this off to my man Leo, because he's the person who took, after, you know, us having a lot of conversations amongst us, he's a person who took like the most momentous next step in doing that.
Well, that's a great handoff. Leo, take it on over. Tell us the more of this crew story. Uh-oh. Oh no, I think you might be muted or something.
So like Scott said, we've been
Yeah,
working
no,
pretty
we got you now.
closely
Go ahead,
with
Leo.
our friends in V Corps, and I just remember being really impressed with the way that a lot of a lot of the members of this caucus were like very disciplined, excellent organizers, and had been around various parts of the organized left for years, and I was just really impressed with their ability to like build an organization where they were. Could broadly appeal to the broader rank and file and really draw in that energy together and kind of like through the act of fighting around these more winnable struggles, in their case actually getting collective bargaining rights within the city of Richmond, able to like have these larger political conversations with their coworkers, because at the end of the day that's kind of what we're trying to do is like with the rank and file caucus model, and essentially what we might call like an intermediate organization or like a pre-political space like you're talking about, be able to like have militants work side by side with the broader rank and file towards these things, and like through that trust building you can have these larger conversations. When you've like been in a ditch with somebody for a year, like callousing your hands, you can talk to them about all sorts of like whatever crank political ideas you might have. And they'll take it a little more seriously than if you were like outside a gate screening or
Absolutely.
handing out newspapers or something. And so we saw a lot of value in that, and we're like,
Absolutely.
we should do this. So I think it was like five of us got together in a Waffle House by the airport. And yes. And
A
I had
classic
a drawn up this
Richmond
basic charter
tableau.
for our chapter, basically establishing our Richmond caucus, and we voted to do it then and there. We all signed this paper, and we just took those first steps. I don't know about, I can't speak for Scott, but I know for myself, like I kind of thrown into this quasi leadership role just out of like just having been the one to do it. But like as we build and grow, we've expanded nationally. We have close to what 16 chapters now, and something like 80 different locals represented in some capacity. There's like so many just natural leaders come in the rank and file itself,
Wow.
that can do a lot better than I can in a lot of things, and it's great being able to like just connect with them and uplift them and. And let them hit the ground running, but that's kind of how we got our start there.
Leo, you give me goosebumps. You give me goosebumps because I think really like the idea of a leaderful movement. I think really, especially all of us here as rank and file union members, is really the most inspiring thing that we could try to create right now. Is imagine that the people standing next to us in the ditch, in the foundation, doing the work, that those people too could judge and decide on things and be leaders, not just in their local, but politically and in their community. Scott, you wanted to say something, and then I want to hear how Emily got in the mix. Go ahead, Scott.
The thing about building the like leaderful movement, we are totally fucking doxing ourselves here at this point. So Leo
Well,
went to Antarctica, right?
yes.
And at the point he did that, he was the chairman of our chapter, right? And we were like, he can't run this thing from Antarctica. We need to put a new guy in there.
They wouldn't send an
A
organizer
guy, a
down. I
person.
tried.
I shouldn't be like this. We have a lot of women in our chapter,
Yeah. You had to
and
keep that under wraps, yeah.
we have this brief, so we have a little like three-member body that like keeps some meetings going and schedule stuff out and that kind of thing. And that's for our chapter, not for national. National needs a larger body to run things. We were like nervous for a second. We're like, oh yeah, we have like, I don't know, five, eight people that could do that job. And we're like, oh yeah, we built something fucking real. Like we built something that people are invested in, where we've like where people really care about and have built the level of skills necessary that they can like walk into a position like that, just run it.
It's
It
a
was a really,
beautiful.
it was
Just to be
honestly,
clear, these
it
are
was a,
not.
you know, it was a great moment.
Just like pulling in from other areas of the organized left. They're just they're rank and file members. You know, we are full of members of various organizations, but that's not really what we are targeted on. You know, we want like natural leaders from the rank and file and people that are willing to do things and take action. You know.
What you're talking about is what's referred to online, I believe, as normies, right? There's this idea that like the normie is this blank slate that, you know, they don't have any views of their own. They're just sort of like an NPC. They walk around with their head in the clouds and listen to whatever it is that CNN or Fox News, depending on who you are, says to them. You know, and I think all of us here, you know that there is no such thing. Like the normie doesn't really exist. But the closest thing to that, I suppose, is the rank and file that you're talking about, which is just your coworkers standing next to you. What do they think about the world? There's a lot of crank ideas, but there's a lot of good ideas. And ultimately, those good ideas are formulated through and brought together and made real by organizations such as your own. One of the filtration methods that's existed for a while is labor notes. And I want to hear from Emily now, because I got a little sneak preview before I pressed the record button earlier. Emily, tell us a little bit about your journey, how you met these crew goofballs and how you ended up part of this project and what it means to you. Go ahead.
So prior to getting into the IBEW, I just worked a bunch of really shitty minimum wage jobs, like selling donuts and making sandwiches and bathing dogs and shit like that. And so I had this very particular idea of what organized labor was going to look like. You know, and then I got into the union, and of course there are all these things that the union promises and really markets itself on anymore that it does deliver. And I was making more money than I'd ever made in my life. You know, I had a pension, I had health insurance, I had all of those things. And I was in every respect completely alienated from like any kind of empowerment as like a working class individual. Mm. You know, there's all of these like symptoms of dysfunction that become really clear in the union. Once you start to develop an understanding of how these kind of unnecessarily complex systems work, you know, we have these labor management cooperation committees, which put us in like a partnership with the contractors. We have pattern bylaws and pattern collective bargaining agreements, which mandate things like no strike clauses, arbitration clauses, prevent us from being able to elect our own job stewards, things like that. You know, a convention delegate system, which is fundamentally undemocratic, you know, issues with a lack of autonomy because of our governing international body. And so I felt extremely disillusioned after I got in and really, really desperately wanted to do something about it. You know, and the Labor Notes convention was having, the Labor Notes was having its convention, and there were all these workshops about like foreign caucuses and union democracy and things mm-hmm. like that. And I was like, I'm going to go there and I'm going to figure out how to build a fucking caucus. And then I got there and then I met the people who had already started building the fucking caucus.
Beautiful thing. Step one was taken out of your hands, right? That was probably a good thing.
Like five white guys from Virginia got the hard part out of the way for me.
Okay. But you met them at the conference and you said, hey, you're electrical workers too. What are you guys up to? Tell me how you kind of fell in with these clowns.
Scott pretty much immediately started out with a pitch, I think.
Nice. Hell yeah.
I don't think there was a whole lot of lead up to it. You know, but crew has proven to be like extremely valuable for me personally. And I think for a lot of us in a number of ways. You know, there's certainly a lack of education, I think, on how all of these complex systems work. You'll meet a significant amount of people like who don't understand things like our pattern contract language and, you know, what's the difference between category one language and category two language and all of these things. So Crews really put together this network of people who are capable of answering each other's questions, educating one another about how the union works, about labor law, all of these various questions that come up in the course of the work that we do. We enable communication between people from locals all over the country who are in these vastly different circumstances, working in vastly different conditions, but also who deal with these sort of same unifying issues that we're all coping with, no matter where we are. We do a lot of skill building workshops. We've transitioned our general meeting structure so that we have meetings that focus just on like polyed and skill building, because we really want to produce people who can do the work, not just people who talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Good stuff. I realized I called you guys both goofballs and clowns, and I want everybody to be clear that I mean that in like the nicest way possible. You know, some of my favorite people are goofballs and clowns. I myself am a clown and a goofball. So I don't want people to get the wrong idea. It's just kind of the way we talk here. One of the things in our special behind the scenes preview, where I forgot to press the record button, that we spoke about was the importance of communication across locals and the ways in which the various internationals, not just in the IBEW, but also, you know, in my union and the carpenters and operating engineers and others, strongly discourage people in different locals from communicating directly with one another about issues on the job, contract issues, whatever it might be, political issues, God forbid, right? So maybe if someone wants to jump in and talk a little bit about that and how Crew might hope to remedy this situation.
I think the easiest way to get that remedied is just talk, you know. So in our secret not recorded episode, I think I spoke about how the tradition of traveling is very strong in the IBEW, traveling for work. If you're not in the trades, you don't always have enough work where you live to get a job. It's just how it is, you know. This is part of why we get paid better. That's why we get paid relatively well. You can go 5 months without a job. This happens.
Right. Yes.
So the tradition of getting on the road for work is very prevalent. The IBEW was founded by travelers. Our founder, Henry Miller, essentially spent his entire working life traveling. A lot of guys spend their entire careers almost traveling. For some people, it's something you do only when you need money. For some people, it's something you might do at the beginning of a career before you finally settle down. So there is like some discouragement of in the rules for the road that you're supposed to follow when you're out traveling. One of them is to not get involved in other locals' affairs. Now, on some level, that makes sense, right? That you don't want to show up in a different local. They're probably running things like they are that's different from where you're from for a reason. And it would be kind of a shitty move to show up to somebody who's hosting you and giving you a job when you need one to poke your nose in. But also, people take it to a level where you're not actually supposed to learn more information. By building out this network, coast to coast, border to border, we found out a lot of things that people in the IBEW simply do not know. I'll give you two examples.
Yeah.
So it is supposed to be category one language in contracts, i.e. mandatory, that I'm oversimplifying, but it's close enough, that we are supposed to have like the final arbiter if management and the union deadlock on a contract is supposed to be an arbitration body up in DC called the Council on Industrial Relations, CIR. It is often used as a club over Southern locals. The most common form of that is either party, the contractors cartel, you're not supposed to call it that. The Contractors Association.
You're in a safe space to call it a cartel here. Go ahead.
That's right. Either the contractors cartel or the union can say, okay, no, we're taking this to arbitration. There's another form where both parties, rarer, where both parties have to decide to go there. Well, it turns out there's at least two locals in Northern California, San Francisco Local 6, and I don't remember the other one, that do not have any reference to CIR in their contract.
Hmm.
And that's supposed to be mandatory for all IBW locals. But I have a contract sitting on my computer right now that is the current contract for Local 6 where that's not in there. The other one is the thing about not being able to elect our stewards.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as we know, there are no construction units which have elected stewards. We haven't managed to find one. But Crew has at least two elected stewards from other types of units, one from a transportation unit and one from what we call a professional industrial unit. So
transportation unit, I guess, is I'm guessing is railroad.
Yeah, it's what is it called? Commuter rail.
Commuter rail. Okay.
Though that so would
it's
include
like a permanent position working for like a regional commuter rail, something like
that's
that.
That's right. So why are we the backbone, the bread and butter, the lifeblood of the IBW not allowed to have elected stewards? We suspect any number of things, but we know that the IBW has a different view of the importance of workers' democracy than we do. That's for sure. And we wouldn't have found these things out without building up this network. Because
yeah.
some guy, you know, who's an electrician on a commuter rail, and I'm not going to say where, but it's in the Midwest, simply would never have come into contact with me. Or a lady who's similarly, she works for a labor nonprofit. Same thing. We would never have come into contact with each other. I'm never going to be on a traveler on her job, you know. But by building out this network, we've learned that like these things that are supposed to be set in stone are actually not. And which
really jogs some ideas, I'm guessing, for you, right? Yeah. Like about what is possible, what is potential.
We have a national right, caucus, right, obviously, right. But we use a chapter system. And when we bring new members in, like we tell them straight up, you know, your focus should be in your local and building your local chapter. That we would love you to like put in some work into the national network, jump in there, but that should be like subordinate first and foremost to organizing your talking to your coworkers. The last thing we ever wanted to become was like another big Facebook group or like Discord server where it's like people complaining a lot, you know, and like nothing actually happens. And you know, we're in the age of like the digital organization, you know, so that's like a real risk that we run. And so we definitely try to hammer that home is like, your local work should be first and then tie it in with the national network so we can share those experiences. We can share resources. We help each other like interpret our contracts, dissect and like work through the constitution, our bylaws, educate each other about like labor law and things like that. And that stuff is really, really helpful. And it's gotten us to this point where, you know, one local may have success, like write a resolution around, you know, a ceasefire in Palestine or other larger political questions, like around like immigrant defense and things like that. And they're able to pass it through. And then next thing you know, we have 10 chapters that are able to pass it through their local, you know, at our relatively small size, like that's pretty promising.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's been successful for us.
I think so. I think your organizing model makes a lot of sense based on the way that our industry is organized. I wonder on that, and I don't want to dox anybody here, but Local 3 is the big one here in New York City and the ones that I've worked with before. I'm not going to break electricians' balls here. I'm not going to give you a hard time about stuff. I'm not going to tell you some of the stuff that I've seen electrical workers do, stuff that reflects, I think, very strong safety laws, very strong codified ways in which you don't want to break your hump, you don't want to break your back. You know, seeing five or six guys trying to raise up like a 100-pound pole might be offensive to some of us other trades, but that's okay. I wonder if... you know, if Local 3, if you've had any penetration in larger cities, and if larger cities, you've already talked about Northern California, face different issues, say, than in West Virginia or Virginia, and how you might, as an organization, try to overcome that.
Contacts in, I would say, most of your big city locals. So, like, New York City, Chicago, blah, blah, blah. Like, think of a big city. We probably have members there, some more than others. But yeah, they definitely face their own kind of set of challenges. You talk about Local 3. I mean, it's like this giant political machine in and of itself. And like some of these locals have like, you know, 22,000 members in them, and they have like more paid full-time staff maybe than Emily's entire local might have, just members, you know. That's been like a wild thing to kind of navigate. Another reason we allow for a lot of local autonomy with chapters, you know, as long as we're all kind of aligned around the same principles, obviously. But we're not in that local, and it's hard to tell them how they need to navigate it. I mean, outside of the like your on paper leadership and you know, political forces within the locals, all those locals have like clubs that have longer histories than some union locals, you know, and they have like these networks. Sometimes it's like ethnic, sometimes it's around
you
know, political affiliation or club affiliation, whatever. So having to navigate all that is really difficult. And like, it's a big reason why we also tell people like your first step should just be a really good coworker and somebody people like respect as a tradesperson on the job. And from there you'll find it a lot easier to kind of like navigate these circles. 'Cause there's less they can use to just dismiss you, you know?
Absolutely. I think the principle that you have, you know, is a real and a powerful one that ultimately, like, and this is true, I think, in all the trades, like your reputation comes from your ability to work. Ultimately, I think you were saying, I'm not sure, Leo, if there was in our secret first half that was unrecorded, which will remain unlistened to by anybody, or it was during this when you talked about you know, the respect that you have to gain when you have calloused hands working next to one another. Like, even the most crank views, I feel like you could accept from the guy, even if he's an alcoholic, even if he's a drug addict, even if he's got like 7 kids from 8 different baby mamas or whatever the case may be. This is one of the ways in which you gain the respect to be able to speak. And some people might find that tyrannous. You know, I find it deeply moving, you know, that one's ability to like navigate this world of work qualifies them ultimately to be able to speak on different matters. It's an older way of thinking about politics.
Yeah.
But I think it's maybe,
I mean, just
one
like
that the
in
left,
a practical sense, it's going to be hard trying to like convince your coworker to help you completely change like our entire political and economic system if you can't like, if you make their life just harder at work, you know what I mean? Like, they're not that, even that basic level of trust isn't there.
Right.
It's going to be very hard to move forward.
Ah, sorry about that. My two nieces and my nephew just arrived from
park. And on top of that, too, you know, just physical presence, like you said, like callous and your hands side by side. You know, if you're in a ditch with somebody for a year, do it like in the mud and you know, being there when it sucks, they're going to listen to you more than somebody outside the gate trying to hand them literature on something or like, you know, a post on social media. Even if our coworkers do put a lot of, you know, stake in social media. But like, oftentimes you just like ask them why they think that or why they think a certain thing. And, it kind of starts to break down past that. It feels superficial. Whereas like easy to connect with them on things that actually like affect them in their real life.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, go ahead.
It was like a year ago. I had just got out to the job that I'm on now. We were on a night shift. If you've ever done like a temporary night shift, the day shift never sets you up.
Never. Oh my God. Yeah. I've been on a 24-hour day, like a 3-shift job. And we just get screwed by the other shifts constantly. And there's no way to do anything about it. Go on.
Right. So we show up there. I got two apprentices and it was like their third day in the trade with me. And, We show up. We couldn't get into the space we were working in, so our foreman tells us, "Yeah, go upstairs. I'll meet you in a bit. I'll lay you out on something else." Okay, cool. So we grab our tools. We head up, and then like a super from the GC comes up to us and confronts us about why we're standing around. I would I told him like I can't get in this room, man. Like he's like, that's bullshit. Like everything's open. I was like, look, man, you got to talk to my foreman, brother. I don't know. Let me be real. The GC supers are, they're not supposed to say anything more to us than, how you doing, brother? You know?
Right. Absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's one of the first things you learn. Yeah.
Right. So, I was lucky because I got to teach these two young men this then and there. He was like, well, you know, if that's the case, then maybe you should go find some other people you can work with. I was like, I'm waiting for my foreman. So he storms off screaming to his phone, you know? I'm still on a job with this guy. He hasn't gotten any better. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So the two apprentices were like, oh, should we go? And I was like, dude, I don't care if Jesus Christ comes up here and tries to lay me out until our union foreman comes here. We're not moving from the spot. So we didn't. One of those guys is in crew already. Was in crew like within a month, you know, cause we were able to show him that example, like right off the bat. And the other guy where, I'm supposed to do a follow-up call with him in the next couple of days, actually. So he should be in pretty soon. So just as exactly like Leo's saying, like showing those examples to people like will bring them in 100%.
Now that's interesting stuff because I've found it's been troubling, let's say, the new crop of apprentices that have come up. And I don't want to be the guy that's just bitching and moaning about his apprentices all the time. Emily's giving the thumbs down to that. I don't want to be that guy. We've all met that guy before. It's not about their quality of work, but without being too harsh on the program that we have here in New York, although I could be probably pretty harsh on it, there are certain skills that are being passed along, but there's certain, let's say like union, like old school sort of stuff, like you were just talking about, Scott, where like, if the super from the GC comes up to you, you tell him, talk to my foreman, right? He's not your direct supervisor. You don't have to speak with him. There's certain things like that. The kids are coming out of the hall and they don't know much about. And so the idea of crew or the idea of a rank and file organization, one that's, a national one that can inculcate this sort of these old school sort of union guidelines and rules for the younger people and bring them along when the union seems or the locals seem to have kind of abrogated that. They've kind of given up on passing this sort of these ideas of dignity and these ideas of contract and work to rule or whatever. They've largely given up on passing that down. I guess it's contingent upon us now to kind of spread this. Emily, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also I'm an apprenticeship instructor as well as still working full time in the field and some other things. This is definitely, I don't know exactly how things work, you know, within the carpenters, obviously. This is a failure of our curriculum, but it's also a failure of our journeymen in the yeah. field. You know, none of that blame can be placed on apprentices.
Absolutely.
You know, but this is one of the really important aspects of, looking at the membership of crew, like the IBEW members who are in crew are by and large the members of locals who are the most committed, you know, people who are teaching apprenticeship classes, people who are stewards on job site, people who are involved in committees, people who are volunteering their time for the hall or for any kind of affiliated effort. These are the people who are members of crew. And it's really important to have these people who are capable, you know, who have that respect, who are capable of being influential, because so much of what we're doing is, building up this network with one another, like, and all of these aspects are really important.
And it's not just, you know, what you're describing, I'm thinking about it, is not just like an organization for the sake of organization. It's not an organization just for building socialism or sort of progressive unionism. It's also, as we were talking about earlier, it's an organization that's expressing some leadership, right? And Emily, what you're describing is like kind of finding ways in which to create leaders who are going to like keep this thing of ours going, you know, which is kind of one of the first principles when you have a trade is like you want to pass down the skills to the next generation. And part of those skills is also, you know, as you train apprentices, is also knowing when they need to stand up for themselves, when they need to stand up for themselves as workers and stand up for their local and stand up for those traditions. So really the leadership is about, it seems to me that crew is part of this process of like building a leadership that stands by tried and true really working class organizational conceptions of dignity on the job, work rules, decent pay, and the ability to kind of pass this thing along, right?
Yeah, I would definitely say there's a degree to which that's true. I mean, fundamentally, I think I said this earlier, but like as an organization, like we don't want people who want to talk about shit. We want people who are going to do shit, and we want to actually accomplish things. And you can't accomplish things without some degree of power. It's just not possible.
Absolutely. Good stuff. I want to broaden the conversation a little bit, and I want to do it in a very millennial way, maybe a very Gen Z way. If you guys open up the chat that we had here to start this conversation, I put a link to X, the Everything app, a post. If you click on it, and if anyone hasn't seen this post from the U.S. Department of Labor, I suppose I can put a link in the show notes here. But this is a post from the U.S. Department of Labor at USDOL in formerly Twitter.com. It says, "We need you," all caps, "to help unleash the golden age of America, apprenticeship.gov. And it's a AI image of a blonde, blue-eyed gentleman looking quite Aryan, wearing like a 1950s style, like blue collar work shirt with an old excavator behind him, and it says, "Your nation needs you." So this is what we're getting right now from the new regime that's been in place since the beginning of this year, Trump 2.0. A lot of the comments here around this idea of the U.S. Department of Labor pushing apprenticeships is allusions to like Nazi propaganda from the 1930s of like Aryans building buildings with Nazi flags behind them and stuff. People talking about how this is racist. Other people who are like, "Yeah, the white man's back, baby. Woo, white man. Yeah, let's fucking go. Finally, Trump is doing something for white men, I guess, getting them off their Call of Duty games and putting them to work in the construction mines or whatever." I wonder maybe like if we want to broaden this out to talk about the way that our society, or at least the way that our nation confronts the trades, confronts organized labor, confronts apprenticeships. Like, what is it that, you know, what's the sense that you guys get on the job among your coworkers in your various different communities about what the building trades means? Like, what does apprenticeship mean? Is there like a political connotation to this? Are we like the four of us just bound to be memes for other people? You know, are we ever going to have our own voices, or are we going to be constant sort of political footballs that every 4 years or so somebody's going to meme? Like, what does society owe us, and what do we owe society? What does the nation, what does it mean that Trump and company are trying to push apprenticeships? I'm throwing a lot of questions at you, but I do want to broaden this discussion out a little bit because this is now national news. Let's start with Emily and let's go around. What are your thoughts on stuff like this, Emily?
I mean, again, I think this is something I briefly referenced earlier, either in this recording or the last one. Who can really keep track of that anymore? But there is like this fetishization of the working class. It occurs like on the right and it occurs on the left, and it looks different in each iteration. And like this is what it looks like from the right.
Yeah.
You know, on the left, it's like, I don't know, fucking Bruce Springsteen and shit.
Bruce Springsteen, maybe before he was on a podcast with Obama, but maybe not.
No, that's exactly it. You know, so I think the attitude that we see like within our union about the apprenticeship, it is largely like this ideal that maybe to a certain degree fits with that our apprenticeships produce like these super extra well-trained like electricians or craftspeople in general who are just like better than everybody else, and we're fucking building America and we're lighting the goddamn path to the middle class and all of this. I think that what that represents on behalf of our union and what maybe some of these like preconceived notions of what like the working class looks like or the organized building trades look like, they're significant of this complete lack of any coherent class politics,
right,
whatsoever. It's about like this identity, or this image or this aesthetic, and it there's absolutely no meaningful class politics, which is just the tremendous failure of absolutely everybody involved in every facet. And to a certain extent, yeah.
I'm sorry if I could jump in, but I think what you say is exactly right. It's fascinating for us to think about, right? Like if you're not defining yourself, then somebody's defining you. Since there is no class politics in this country because it's degraded and deformed, of course, everybody else is going to try to impose something upon you because you're not creating something yourself. I just wanted to reiterate, in other words, what you yourself were saying. I'm sorry, Emily, continue.
But I was just going to say, as far as like what I think the way that you phrased the question initially was like, what does society owe labor and what does labor owe society? I think it's fundamentally more about what do we owe ourselves? Mm-hmm. I mean, what society exists without labor? Like, where do you draw the line? What's the difference? How do you define those things? I do think for me, at least, the fundamental question is what do we, like in organized labor, what do we as the working class owe ourselves? How do we build that?
Hell yeah. I like that answer.
Yeah. So
let's go next to Leo. What are your thoughts on this?
For much of the union's history, there was no registered apprenticeship program, I mean, not that I don't agree that there is, might be necessary to have some sort of standards around this stuff. But when they first started popping up, they were run through the unions. But then with Taft-Hartley kind of like separated all that out, made it illegal for us essentially to run our own apprenticeship programs. It's a joint training alliance with our contractors cartel, and so people that isn't like often explained a lot to our membership too. So there's always a lot of like frustration about how and what we're teaching the apprentices, not realizing like it's like legally been taken out of our hands in a lot of way. We have to like sit on a board with the contractors and develop a program together with them. It's not like something we can run ourselves. Part of also why I think they want to push. I looked through that link on the on that Twitter site. I didn't see any union apprenticeships listed on there. I didn't look very far, but they didn't seem like they were pushing those.
They have been making
legal efforts over the last few years to like equalize the non-union and the union apprenticeships. Before it was like, I don't really believe in this, but a lot of people in the union, see like our higher level of training as a big reason for our higher wages and things like that. I think you'd be hard pressed to sell your union apprenticeship training to a non-union contractor for the same package, but that's a different conversation. But it's really like, it sucks seeing stuff like this. And I think there's no like, you're not born blue collar or born working class. Like class is something that's made. It's not like inherent to you. And so there's not like a distinct blue collar culture that everybody knows and everybody sees. I mean, we have things that are like unique to us, and we can play those up or down like as we need it. But like, you see, you go to any big job and it's like, you got blue haired kids playing Magic the Gathering. You got guys talking about their hunting fish clubs. You got
absolutely,
depending on your local, you might have like masons or something, or we got trans people in our locals, and some of my best friends and coworkers, and it always sucks like hearing other people that are ostensibly like on my side say we need to be more reactionary to appeal to people like me, so that I was like, these are my coworkers and my friends, and these are people like I callous my hands with, like we said, every day on the job, and you're going to come tell me, like, we need to push these people to the side to, like, appeal to me. And then on the other side of that, you got, like, people that'll just write the building trades off as hopelessly reactionary.
Right.
Not even worth the time, which I also disagree with, but I also can, depending on where you're coming from in your organizing world, see how you might come to that conclusion, you know. But I think the fact remains we need to build a combative working class tendency, not only in our unions, but in the working in this country as a whole. And to do that, we need to be in the workplace. You know, we got to be there on the job. It's like there's no other way in place from which you can do that.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. Scott, I'll give you the last word on this question. Go ahead.
You should not have, because there's something about the high level of abstraction that this question is at that just like bounces off my brain.
It's hard for you. I get it.
It is. But look, I got in this trade kind of late in life. I was 39, right? I was divorced. I have a 20-year-old. I have a kid in college right now, right? Like I had a whole career. I had a whole life before I did this, and I can't. It's really hard for me to express the level that this union changed my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that being part of the degenerated or shadowy version of a workers' democracy that we have has changed my life. And like a big part of that is recognizing that like this is exactly like we're saying, there are blue haired kids, there are a lot of people of color, there are a lot of women. So I said earlier that, you know, if you walk back to maybe 2020, 2019, we had roughly 67 women in our local. Now it might be 200,
right?
You know, like this guy, there's not that many of them on my job. You know, the primary language on my job is Spanish. Mm-hmm. My local has had an enormous increase in numbers over the last year or so by really nailing down how to reach out to Latinos, you know. Like a lot of cats who like walked here from Venezuela, you know, are now earning six figures by doing electrical work for Richmond 666. And to have this fucking administration reduce it to what they're trying to show here really, really, really fucks with me, man. I wish I could address this question at the level of abstraction that the question is looking for. But like, I almost want to say that society owes us everything. We owe everything to society, but that's not meaningfully touching on any class politics. It's almost like a corporatist view.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's wrong, right? Like, maybe the reason why, Scott, that I wasn't trying to trip you up by getting to this level of abstraction, but this is kind of where my head went, and this is kind of where, when you met me, Scott, last year, where I was maybe kind of shifting my views on some things and have shifted them. Like, one of the things that I think about people like us, like the four of us and the millions of us around this country, that bears repeating and bears thinking about is that society, which is to say capitalist society, which is to say the kind of society that needs data centers, the kind of society that needs high tension power lines, needs commuter rail systems, needs foundations, you know, needs water treatment plants. Society in general takes a strong interest that there be people like us, if not actively at work, like hanging around, you know, with the means to kind of survive until society needs us to jump in and like build a whole bunch of stuff for us. And so the trades in my mind, one of the ways that I kind of understand it is like going back 100 years or so, capitalists, the nation state and society kind of deciding that there's a section of the working class that we need to have like skilled up, pretty well fed and ready to go whenever there's like an economic boom coming, whenever there is like a vast need, like when a hurricane comes and all of a sudden all the power lines in an entire state are knocked out. You need to be sure that you have electrical workers all over this country who have the skills and are ready to go and ready to jump in so that the feds, that FEMA could put like billions of dollars to make sure that a state has electricity again. And so, like, this is all a way of saying that it's not just the Trump administration, it's also the Biden administration and Trump 1.0 and Obama before him, all the presidents going back maybe to the beginning, but at least for the last 150 years or so, who have taken an interest in what we do broadly, the working class does, and ensure that there are various different institutions, some of them trade unions, some of them apprenticeship.gov. You know, there's various institutions in place to make sure that what society needs from us, society can get from us, you know, from our skills. And so, you know, people want to say that Trump's post or the Department of Labor's AI post of that Aryan-looking guy is fascism. And I would say yes, it is. Only in the sense that, like, FDR also and the propaganda coming out of the 1930s and the integration of the working class into democracy and American life in the 1930s was also vaguely fascist as well. Anytime we start to nod towards some sort of union of some corporatist union of the cartels, as you call them, and the unions with the state in between, we're on fascist territory, right? The question for all of us, as you guys build a leadership organization of the class, is like, how long are we going to be played as a political football? How long are we going to have our real true skills and our work in creating, recreating, maintaining, and building this society? How long are we going to have the structures of that put in somebody else's hand, whether it be the contractors or whether it be like the Trump administration? How long are we going to sit on the sidelines and allow them to define us culturally? You know, define us by our hair color or our eye color, define us by whether we're union or non-union citizen or non-citizen man or woman, right? And what I think is exciting about your project, and I think dovetails very nicely with groups like the Southern Workers Assembly or the Northern Workers Assembly, as you like to call the ILC, is that we pose the question of class as a question of leadership. And not in a sort of abstracted Twitter.com sort of way where people are nodding to like Bolsheviks and Mensheviks in a foreign country 100 and something years ago, but like true class leadership. Like I think Emily, Leo, and Scott, you guys are trying to build on a chapter by chapter, local by local basis. And so I think that while the question of what do we owe society, what does society owe us, maybe is a little bit abstract, I think it really does get to the heart of the way in which all of us feel like our labor is being used, our identities, our work, our locals in our community, the ways in which we as a class are being used for somebody else's directions, for somebody else's interests. And so with that, I guess I've answered the question myself that I've asked you guys, which is a common podcaster's trait. So I apologize. But Leo, you have your hand raised. Maybe respond.
I would
Maybe
agree.
you
I
just
would
want
agree
to
with
tell
all
me
of
to
that.
fuck myself. Maybe you want to call me a
My
clown.
man
Go ahead.
Scott
Either
here
which way.
has one of my favorite lines that I will repeat now. But you know, our unions, like we're the IBEW, still very mobbed up, but it's not with an Italian crime family, right? It's with the Democratic Party. We're a big we're the you know we're pro we were the probably the biggest Joe
Aha,
Biden
yes.
union. You know, we endorsed him faster, I think, than any other union, you know? So maybe this is a
You
transition
did,
to
and I
that,
was
but
going to bring that up,
you
so
know,
thank you for bringing it up for me.
the but that's because like our union and the way that craft unionism in general is set up, they don't see unions as like a vehicle for the independent like political activity of the working class, right? We're essentially like temp agency with benefits. We're like a reserve army, because so much of our work comes from these large like municipal projects and like infrastructure projects and things that have to like go through this entire political machine to actually get to the point where it's being bid by our contractors. We're heavily like invested in that world and be able to like have a you know a foot in that world, and because their primary focus is keeping members employed. I mean, that's just what it is. Like Sean Fain with the UAW, it's the same thing with every union. All these, the NLRA kind of leads all back to that. Where it's keep the members employed. Good old fashioned unionism, bread and butter issues. Larger political questions are not supposed to be of this realm, And so we would love to change that. We would love to build more political independence within our class, to divest ourselves from that like two-party system, and work towards a world in which like we as rank and file workers can have a heavy say in what does and does not get built, and not just have to beg for the work, whatever it is coming downstream. There's like that big joke where it's like, if they were ever going to come to our city and like build a factory that kills electricians, like we would be right there trying to get the work to build it. That would be us, you know. Yeah.
Right. How many man hours are we talking about? That's a really good response. Emily, what do you think about all this? Sorry to put you on the spot here.
No, I mean, I think that, did any of you guys, did your halls get those IBEW for Biden t-shirts around election time?
I think they were just too hung afraid them up to in our halls, like, so hand them out. Them and they had the boxes of them. I did not see them trying to hand them out anywhere.
I remember going into the hall and whoever was in there at the time was like, do you want this? Like, they're just giving them away. And like, you cannot find a group of people who loves like knickknacks more than like electricians love knickknacks. And I was like, no, I don't want that. Does anybody want that? I never saw anybody wear one.
You know, when someone's turning down swag, you know, that you really messed up. So you're not wearing your Biden electoral workers for Biden shirt today to this podcast, unfortunately.
No, I just I wear that to sleep in the privacy of my own home. You know, I don't want people to know about that. That's just embarrassing. I was just going to say, I think that I don't know exactly like precisely what part of that you wanted me to riff off of in particular.
But I should go wide with it. Yeah.
In terms of like the politics of it all, I think any given day, like if you go on a job site, it won't be in precisely this language, like, but you're going to hear construction workers talk about the fact that they feel alienated from like the contemporary American political situation. They feel alienated from the fucking labor that they're performing. I think that's extremely common rhetoric. I think it's very clear. This is something that we talked about a little bit together before we got on here. But I think it's very clear that at least for me, even these sort of like diehard old school, like union Democrats are barely even like buying the shit that they're trying to sell. I think there's so much energy. There's so much apathy and disenfranchisement like among members of organized labor at this point. And a lot of that stems from like this, you know, this political system that doesn't in any way, shape or form service any of us, like regardless of how they may pay lip service to, you know, to organized labor or the building trades or the working class in general. I think like the sensible point to move towards there is like independent political formations, you know, for the working class. But like in order to get there, like the work that we're doing right now is the work that has to be done first. I think that we've seen, you know, the dangers of relying on electoralism or legalism within our own unions. We've seen exactly how that plays out. There are two political parties and neither of them do anything for the working class. Like we exist in an inherently hostile legal framework that we somehow still believe is like, beneficial for us. The only way forward, I think is essentially the strategy that the crew is taking, and it's building the rank and file and it's building it from the ground up.
Hell yeah. I can't say I disagree with any of that. We crossed a threshold on this podcast episode where it got to 1 hour. And as the clock was ticking down, I'm seeing on the screen here, I wasn't sure what was going to happen at 1 hour, if it was going to cut us off or not, if we were going to like run out of you know, like you put quarters in the machine. When you used to make a phone call, you know, you'd put like a bunch of quarters in and it'd tell you you had like a minute left. But we continue and we move on. We've made it past the hour point right now. I think this has been a really good discussion. I would only ask all of you, and maybe if two of you are down and a third person needs to go, that's fine. I wonder if maybe you'd have another 20 minutes or so, 25, 30 minutes to speak about things, and we could talk about such diverse topics as Antarctica, the DSA convention, data centers. We could talk all sorts of stuff. So if you are cool with that, go ahead and give me a thumbs up and we could take this to the other side of the paywall. We got three thumbs up and we got mine as well. So folks, if you're not a patron of our podcast, patreon.com/theantifada, one of you, it doesn't matter who, let the people know, especially if they're electrical workers, or maybe if they're in other trades or no trade at all, if they're interested in knowing more about Crew, where they might find you.
Yeah, so we have a website. It's called rankandfilecrew.org. That might be the easiest way to get a hold of us. If you are an electrical worker, not unionized or not, if you are a unionized worker, not in the electrical trade or industry, but you are represented by an electrical union, or if you are any member of the building trades, we would love to get in contact with you. We also want to help the other trades set this up and share some experiences. We've been trying to get that going as well. It's going to take all of us. I mean, we work right next to each other, so it has to happen that way. But rankandfilecrew.org, drop us a line. That email there works. We respond pretty quickly.